People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, on the 15th of May, there is an opera which will be opening here at the Artscape Opera House, featuring the UCT Opera School and Cape Town Opera in Bellini's opera about Romeo and Juliet, I Capuleti e Montecchi. The conductor is Jeremy Silver, who has also recently been appointed director of the UCT Opera School. Jeremy studied languages and music at Clare College in Cambridge and conducting at the Royal College of Music. And he furthered his operatic studies at the National Opera Studio in London, where 15 years later he formed part of the artistic leadership team. And a number of opera productions have followed also here in South Africa. So Jeremy, welcome. It's good to have you finally here in the Fine Music Radio studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
This new appointment, before we start talking about the opera, must be quite an exciting thing. First of all, to come to the tip of Africa and to an opera school which I think has almost a kind of international reputation.
It absolutely does. In fact, I would say at the moment the eyes of the opera world in Europe are on this school, because there's no doubt that there's more raw talent, certainly in this country operatically, than anywhere else in the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. So if we can train it to a high standard, these people are going to take the opera world by storm, and in fact are already doing so, of course. There are some big names out there already.
Yes, many of whom passed through the UCT Opera School.
They did, yes.
It is, I love that phrase you use, raw talent, because in a sense, the fact that the talent is raw is very much to the advantage of people training and teaching, isn't it?
Very much so. They come with some sort of unbelievable instinct about vocal technique. They come with a passion for opera. They come with what appears to be more instinctive knowledge than I've ever seen in anybody. They sing with reasonable Italian already. They sing with a great sense of operatic style. But of course, our job then is to hone the technique a little bit, certainly to teach languages to a very high level, because that's now a prerequisite in Europe. And stagecraft. Acting has become such... Well, it's almost been revolutionized in opera. But in the past, you could sing with meaning and intensity and more or less stand there and let the music speak for itself. Nowadays, it really needs to look like a theatre or film, partly, I guess, because of high-definition broadcasts.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And also the directors these days. Directors are being much more daring on their, not only in the setting, mm-hmm. the concept of the staging, but in what they want the singers to actually do physically.
Absolutely they are. And rightly so, I think. It is, you know, the ultimate joint performing experience, isn't it, of music, of acting, of all other scenic aspects. So I think that's all to the good, providing, of course, that things don't get in the way of singers' ability to really sing and providing it doesn't take the place of great musical meaning.
Yeah, and not too distracting for the audience. Interesting, but not too distracting.
Sure.
Doesn't one read many reviews these days of operas in Europe and elsewhere where the critic is furious about the director kind of interfering with the music, really?
Very much so. I don't think one can interfere, but as long as one's supporting it, as long as the meaning, the characterization, the emotions, the psychology are being supported both musically and dramatically, then you've got a pretty amazing experience on your hands.
You sound wonderfully enthusiastic, which is such good news. It's a new job, relatively speaking, for you.
Yes.
Here, as I said, on the tip of Africa, and it's as we said, also a company that's world-renowned, almost, will be coming world-renowned. So you must be rather excited about plans ahead and sort of thinking, gosh, I must get my hands on this and really make my presence felt.
I am very excited. As I say, to have such amazing young talent to work with is fantastic. But also to know that there are people in the world at large who are absolutely sitting there waiting for this, to employ this talent, mm-hmm. is really very exciting. Which is not to say, of course, that I'm not very keen that they should all work here as well. It would be terrible if they all left the country. But as I remind them quite often, I don't think there are singers in any country in the world who, sadly, are able to earn a living in one country alone. Mm-hmm. They all travel. They all have to travel, not because it's glamorous, but because they have to.
Okay. So, Jeremy, is this particular production of this Bellini opera, is it, it's your first one as head of music at the opera school?
It is.
But you have been many times to this country, apparently, and conducted a number of operas. We sort of know you well, don't we?
Well, I don't know. I've been to Cape Town only a few times. I conducted a couple of operas at Cape Town Opera. There was La Boheme in 2012, I think. Marriage of Figaro in 2014, which was also Christine Krauser's last production as artistic director, so that was a very exciting thing to do. And I did come to UCT at the end of 2016 to take over the Magic Flute, and we did masses of wonderful rehearsal, but sadly we didn't then perform that year.
I remember that.
It was postponed a year, and then my predecessor, Kamal Khan, actually conducted the performances in the end. So those are my experiences here in Cape Town, but I've conducted a fair amount in Pretoria and in Durban over the years. I first conducted in this country in 2004, and I think I've worked here in some capacity almost every year since.
Mm-hmm. Does it feel good to be living here? Can you say yet that you're living here? Have you got yourself a place to stay and settled and all your books and bits and pieces?
No, not quite. I'm renting a flat from the university at the moment, having only really arrived in February. I think I'll probably always keep a citizen of two countries, to be honest. I haven't quite got the confidence to give up my home in London, which I also love, and it's a great city. But I do see myself being here for a long time. I love it here. I've felt at home in South Africa for many, many years. My late wife was South African, so we were here often.
She was a singer as well, wasn't she? She was a soprano.
Absolutely. She was a soprano who had started life in Durban, then sung a lot at the State Theatre in Pretoria, and several things down here as well.
And remind us of her name?
Well, she's known in Europe as Sally Silver, but she was known here as Sally June Gain. But it's, I mean, apart from a concert we did here a few years ago with Lawrence Brownlee, her performances in South Africa have mainly been, you know, more than 20 years ago, because obviously she moved to Europe.
Right.
There was definitely a Traviata at Cape Town Opera. There was definitely a Pagliacci at Spear. I'm not quite sure what else was down here.
Okay. So you really do have, in a sense, some roots in South Africa already, even though you're just starting a new job here, so to speak.
I do feel it. Lots of friends, many family. So, yes, completely.
Now, Jeremy, what I'd like to do is, I'd like to talk about this Bellini opera, which you're working on, and just for you to give us some insight into it. So let's whet our appetites by listening to an excerpt. And your first choice of music, I think, is one of the excerpts from I Capuletti e I Montecchi by Bellini. What have you chosen and what are we going to hear?
I have chosen the Juliet's, or Giulietta, as she's known in the opera, her first aria. So this happens about 15, 20 minutes into the piece. And we're introduced to a character who is already being forced by her father to marry somebody else, and who is already deeply in love with Romeo, or Romeo, as known in the Italian.
Yes, in Italian, yeah.
And we just see her dreadful
dilemma, I suppose.
Yes.
Is that right?
Dilemma, because there's the person she loves, who happens to be a member of a rival family, a rival political faction, or there's the man who her father has chosen, which is a political appointment, if you like. So we're put straight in the middle of her crisis.
Okay, well, let's listen to that short scene from the opera.
Thank you.
There you are, an excerpt from the opera by Bellini I Capuletti e Montecchi. And tell us a little bit about who was singing, Jeremy.
That was Beverly Sills in a recording conducted by Giuseppe Patané. She was the most extraordinary bel canto singer, an American singer who I love technically and I love her emotional commitment. I have to say there are times when I find her performances a little bit overt, a little bit, I guess, American for my humble European tastes.
Okay.
But the fact that she's with a European conductor, it somehow has all come together, and I just think it's the most stunning recording of the piece. The Romeo, by the way, is Janet Baker, also a wonderful, wonderful singer.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Let me just tell you, by the way, that Jeremy Silver is my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, the director of the Opera School and also the conductor of this Bellini opera. And is it, so let's talk a little bit about this production. Is the Romeo always sung by a mezzo?
Yes.
Is it written like that by
Bellini? It is absolutely written that way. Of course, I guess there had been a huge history of women taking male roles during Handel's time and so forth. It was already getting a little bit out of date by the time Bellini wrote this in 1830, but there were precedents for it, and he took this commission on at very, very late notice. Another composer was supposed to be writing the opera, took on far too many jobs all at once and had to pull out. So Bellini was asked to do it. He knew the theatre he was writing for very well. He knew the singers. He loved the mezzo. He wasn't so keen on the tenor or the baritone. So he just made the decision, okay, I'll write it for a mezzo-soprano.
Right.
Which is extraordinary in many ways because the piece itself, if you're looking at the roles, the named roles, how it's all men. The named roles are all men. It's the male chorus almost all the way through, apart from one very, very short excerpt where a ladies' chorus sing a funeral procession for Giulietta. And so really, the only female character on stage is Juliet. Our Romeo is also a woman. So that's quite an interesting modern sort of gender politics sort of conundrum for us to grapple with.
But you are doing it that way here in Cape Town, aren't
Absolutely.
You? With a mezzo.
Absolutely. There have been times, I think, in the past where they've tried to recast it. I think Abbado recast it in the 60s at La Scala with a tenor. It's not Bellini then.
Right. Mm. And isn't it interesting, Jeremy, that Romeo and Juliet has inspired so much music, let alone the Tchaikovsky overture, but Gounod's opera?
There's
as
a
well.
Gounod opera, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess there's also Bernstein's West Side Story, which
well,
is
yes,
basically
absolutely.
Romeo and Juliet.
It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Berlioz as well as Tchaikovsky, of course, in the concert hall. So, it's an extraordinary story, iconic story. Most of these have not come from Shakespeare. Some have, but many have gone back to the same sort of sources that Shakespeare went back to,
okay.
Particularly this opera by Bellini. So, okay.
And when one thinks of Bellini, one thinks of the typical sort of bel canto style. Is it typical of Bellini, this opera? Is it an early, middle, late opera of Bellini's?
It is typical. It's one of his earlier pieces. I mean, listen, he had such a short life. It's
well,
very difficult to talk about early and late. But it came immediately after his first big success. And I guess it's typical in the sense that the music is very melody-led. It's extraordinarily emotionally charged. In this particular case, not a spare note anywhere. It's quite sparse in a really intense way.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly orchestrally, if it doesn't need to be written, he didn't write it. And that puts a huge amount of responsibility on the singers, but it also makes it an incredibly intense experience for the audience.
Are you working with the Cape Town Philharmonic?
No, not on this occasion. With our UCT-CTO collaborations, we sometimes do,
mm-hmm.
but I've got the UCT Symphony Orchestra
oh, right,
this time,
okay.
which is lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. And gives them a chance to be a pit orchestra for a while.
Very much so.
Because they do mostly concerts.
They do, of course. So this is an incredibly useful experience for them.
Yeah.
And useful just to get to know the style of the music, which I'm always very keen to point out to them is no different to the style of a pianist playing Chopin or Schumann. It's all the same period of music, and we should treat it the same way.
Oh, that's interesting. Because, of course, it is, isn't it? Exactly the same time.
Yes, completely. And I think Chopin and Bellini, you know, have so much in common. And I think one has to be careful sometimes that it, you know, Bellini and Donizetti and Rossini have, amongst music lovers, some absolutely adore this repertoire, some don't particularly like it. And I think it's music that can really exist on a knife edge. If you play it on the Chopin side of that fence, as it were, it is the most beautifully rich and inspiring music. If you play it on the other side, it can, if you'll excuse me, come out a little bit like Italian second-rate band music.
Okay.
And it's very important that one actually, you know, plays
just
it.
Just the right, yeah.
Absolutely.
And, Jeremy, what about the actual production? Who's directing?
It's being directed by a wonderful man called Stephen Stead. He has directed opera in Cape Town before, but he and I met originally as we were both on the staff of English National Opera many years ago. He was a staff director, I was a staff conductor, but he now runs a wonderful theatre company in Durban called Kickstart. They were responsible recently for Into the Woods at the Theatre in the Bay.
That's right. But we know his name well, I think, mostly from theatre, funnily enough.
Absolutely. I think it's at least 10 years since he's directed an opera, but I was determined I wanted him to do it. I mean, he's wonderful. We also worked in Pretoria together on a couple of operas. He's a wonderful, wonderful director and a good teacher,
which is, of course,
important when you've got a semi-student cast, in any case.
And the setting, is it fairly conventional? He hasn't done anything terribly modern.
Well, it's not set on a spaceship or anything like that.
Okay.
It's sort of timeless. It doesn't look ridiculously modern in any way. What's important for him is to make sure that the characters really come alive, that you really see into their emotions and to their thoughts. I think it's a very beautiful production to look at, but I mean, it's not 15th century or anything like that.
Okay, and not ultra-modern, as we said earlier, with some directors who do weird things.
Indeed, no, not at all. It's conventional in many ways, but beautiful.
I'm Jeremy. We're going to have another piece of music now, and we're talking about opera, and I know you've chosen some Mozart. Clearly, opera is your great love. Is that true?
It has become so. It was not something that I was deeply involved with as a child. Orchestral music was what absolutely obsessed me at that time. But I was persuaded to work on an opera back in 1989 by a friend. I said to him, look, I don't have a clue, I can't do this. And he said, no, I think your skills fit it. And I was chorus master, repetitor, and conducted the matinee performance of this particular opera. And I have not left opera for a day since.
Good grief.
And have really grown to love it.
May I ask which opera that was?
That was Donizetti's L'Elisire d'Amore. But as soon as I did it, other people were asking me to do things, and it did suit my skill sets. It's unbelievable. It's a love of music, but it's a love of languages, which was a really big part of my upbringing, and of theatre and of humanity. Ultimately, that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. So, what are we going to hear from that rather extraordinary opera, The Marriage of Figaro?
Well, I knew it had to be something from The Marriage of Figaro because I think, in many ways, it could claim to be the greatest opera ever written. So that was clear. And I've chosen the Sextet from Act 3 because I think of all the composers who wrote operas, Mozart had an uncanny ability to see right into the heart of people. And to create a sextet like this with six characters on stage, often singing together, where you simultaneously laugh and cry with whoever character you're focusing on at the time, is, I think, just a thing of genius.
Stesso non mi fate più arrossì resistenza alla coscienza far non lascia il tuo desir
e il suo padre e la sua madre dimmi ne io non so servir e il suo padre e la sua madre
son smarrito si amati
Alto, alto, signor Conte, mille doppie son qui pronte, a pagar vengo per Figaro, ed a porlo in libertà.
Lasciane qua,
The sextet from Act 3 of The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, another choice of my guest on People of Note this week, the conductor Jeremy Silver, who's in town to conduct Bellini's opera I Cappelletti e I Montecchi. Although I say in town, Jeremy, because let's say this is your home now, you've got to start calling it home.
I must.
Who was conducting that performance?
That was a fairly recent recording conducted by Yannick Negé-Séguin, who's a Canadian conductor and the new music director of the Metropolitan Opera New York.
Right, and a bit of a whiz kid. He's one of these sort of real stars, isn't he?
He really is, but his music making is not starry. It's better than that, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes. I do. A tragedy about James Levine as well, because I thought he took the Met to the most amazing. You do wish people just remember the good things, don't you?
Yes,
but anyway,
I absolutely agree.
I mean, let's not
he's
go
been
there.
Amazing.
Yeah. Jeremy, you mentioned languages earlier, and I said you studied languages and music at Clare College. Maybe it's not such a weird combination, or is it? Why languages? What was the attraction there?
I just grew up being obsessed by languages and music, and I guess these were my father's two passions. You know, both my parents were musicians, but my father had studied French at university and sort of introduced us to the concept of language very early, and I just got obsessed by grammars and things. I mean, what a nerd, but I did. And so took it through. As I say, the languages I did at university were actually Spanish and French, so not the most useful operatic languages by any means. But enough to really push me on my way with all the others.
Does that mean, if you studied languages, does that mean that you're a bit of a linguist? I mean, do you speak about 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 languages?
I can get by in quite a few languages. I think I'm a far better academic linguist than speaking linguist. But yes, if I have to speak, you know, French, Spanish, Italian, whatever, yes, I can certainly
And does this come in useful in your job as a conductor of opera?
Very much so. Not only because of the languages that the operas are in, of course, and training singers, you know, to a very high level in their, not just their pronunciation, but their real genuine understanding of a language, so that they can express themselves authentically. It's not enough that they just know how to pronounce it, mm-hmm. because it'll always sound a little bit removed.
And isn't it interesting, Jeremy, how no matter how good the translation is, an opera doesn't sound as good in English, doesn't it, if it's been written in German or French? I know the English National Opera famously, I mean, The Ring in English of all things, but it doesn't work for me.
You know, I'm in two minds. I personally prefer working on opera in the original language, but I think that's partly because I love languages. But I can't find a good enough reason to object to opera also being performed in the language of the audience.
Fair enough.
And I have done several. During my time at English National Opera, there was only one opera that I just could not deal with in English, and that was Pelléas et Mélisande. And there's something about the sound of the French which is so quintessential for that opera.
That's an interesting thought, actually. Imagine that being sung in English. I can't. But you mentioned the orchestral. I want to talk about your orchestral side, because we've been speaking about opera, and you came to opera, I think we can say, relatively late. Yeah. So you'd been studying music. You had these musical parents. Was it always... Were you always going to be a musician?
I was always going to be a musician, but that doesn't mean a professional musician. So yes, I mean, I worked very hard and enjoyed myself immensely as a child and as a teenager and through my university years. My father's advice was always very firmly, don't take this up as a career, because, you know, you need a bit of stability in life and, you know, there's no guarantees with this. And I guess that's one of the reasons I decided to go to university to study languages. Mm-hmm. I just thought, well, it could give me a career in something else. And yes, I studied languages and I did very well, but I probably played in a concert every night.
And after naughty.
Yes, exactly. After 2 years, I just thought to myself, who am I kidding? It's about time I made a choice. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about degrees at Oxford and at Cambridge is that they're split into two distinct parts, and you can change direction after, you know, as you start your part two, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I did. I just thought, okay, here we go. Moved over to musicology. It was a very academic course, but then after that, managed to get to the Royal College of Music to study conducting.
Was the piano your instrument?
The piano was always my principal instrument. Yeah. I was also a violinist and violist eventually. And those were the sort of concerts I was playing at university, just in orchestras all around the place.
And those will give you a good basis to be a conductor, certainly the piano, wouldn't it?
Yes. The piano's great for harmony. It's great to get into opera, of course, because you usually start as a coach and as a repetiteur and so forth. And I found that with my particular brand of piano playing, which was never destined for being a concerto soloist, but which was... I'd much rather sit down and busk symphonies, or jazz for that matter.
Really?
Yeah. You know, as a repetiteur, you need to be able to create a great orchestral sound. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know the job existed until it came my way, and I suddenly found it fitted me like a glove.
So how did you then, what attracted you to the world of conducting?
I think what it was, I just fell in love with the sound of the orchestra. I got dissatisfied with the sound of the piano, which I have actually since rediscovered. But at that time, I was just overwhelmed with the possibilities of colour of orchestras, and I loved the symphonic repertoire. So that was where I was heading, mm-hmm. I guess.
And so you did your fair share of conducting concerts and symphonies and concertos, the sort of mainstream conducting jobs, so to speak.
Absolutely.
To take the glamour away for it from a moment.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I did a fair amount of that. Until one day a friend of mine who I'd actually studied with said to me, look, for years, he said, I've been working as an assistant conductor, repetiteur and chorus master on a London Opera Festival. It's called Opera Holland Park. It was in a slightly different guise in those days. And he said, look, I want to go off and do a competition next summer, and they're asking me to find a replacement. Would you think of doing it? And my answer to him was, no, don't be ridiculous. I don't know enough about opera. Absolutely no way. And he twisted my arm. And I turned up and did it. I worked. I studied like anything to make sure that I achieved. And that was 1989. Remarkably, I haven't left opera for a day since. And I love it. And I worked very hard in the beginning to sort of take repertoire on board. And now it's become an absolute passion.
And do you enjoy the whole repertoire? Do you have a specific specialized section of opera? Because opera is so vast these days, especially, isn't it?
It is vast. I don't necessarily have a specialization. I do, a lot of the bel canto repertoire has come my way, and it's a repertoire that divides people. Some people don't like it, so some people would call that a speciality of mine. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would have said to you, well, I never touched the Baroque. I had sort of come of age musically at a time when the period instrument movement was saying to us, look, we've got a secret here. You either jump on board or you don't. And as a teenager, I decided not to jump on board. So I sort of didn't do it for many years. Until once again, about 5 years ago, I had my arm twisted. I conducted my first Handel opera. I then conducted one for the following 2 years. And 2 years after that was even more daring. And this was just last year, did Monteverdi's Popea. Loved it. thought that ranked, if Figaro is possibly the greatest opera ever written, Monteverdi's Popea has to be close behind.
Gosh, okay. But now, Jeremy, we've had two opera excerpts. Now, we spoke about the sound of the orchestra and how much you've loved it. And your third choice actually intrigues me because it's one of the truly great recordings of the century, isn't it? Carlos Kleiber, the most enigmatic of conductors.
Absolutely.
And his Brahms IV with the Vienna Philharmonic. I'm just going to ask you to put you in a spot why you particularly like this recording. And I'm sure I know what you're going to say.
Well, I mean, there's, with everything that Carlos Kleiber conducted, there seems to be no distance between his idealization of the piece and what comes out of the orchestra. It's unbelievable. His flexibility, his insight into the music, and just, he had the most extraordinary way of communicating these things directly to an orchestra. He created the most beautiful orchestral sound ever, always balanced, which you can't say for everybody. I just think he was in a class of his own as a musician and a human being.
You know, we're lucky these days because there's so many DVDs around, and there are DVDs made of his rehearsing and all that. And even his rehearsals, what you hear him say to the orchestra, he says quite a lot, but he doesn't speak too much. And his baton technique and just what he does with his hands, this is the communication thing I think you're talking about.
Completely unconventional. I mean, you know, a conducting teacher would look at it and say, oh, there's no technique there at all. But it absolutely conveys so much more than any formal technique could.
Okay, so you've chosen the second movement of this magnificent symphony by Brahms, which is about 13 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to be ruthless and cut it. But is that what you would like to hear? This is Kleiber conducting the Vienna Philharmonic, Carlos Kleiber, in the second movement of Brahms Symphony No. 4. sometimes in this business it's very difficult pulling down a fader in such glorious music. Sorry about that, Jeremy. That rather magnificent second movement of Brahms's Fourth Symphony, the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by the ever enigmatic Carlos Kleiber. And you remember, Jeremy, the BBC Music Magazine a couple of years ago had a competition, I suppose you call it, and they asked 125 conductors who their favorite conductors, famous conductors, mm-hmm. and Carlos Kleiber came out tops.
I'm not surprised at all.
But you know who was second, which I'm not sure I agree with, but nonetheless, and that was Claudio Abbado.
Really?
Right high up there. Mm. But he, I mean, everything Kleiber did, the Beethoven 5 and 7, for example, aren't those great recordings?
Unbelievable.
His Tristan.
That is by far the greatest Tristan recording ever made.
Well, I have a conductor with me in the studio, Jeremy Silver, who is now director of UCT Opera School and is conducting the Bellini opera I Capoletti e Montecchi for Cape Town Opera and UCT Opera, which opens on the 15th of May. But we were talking earlier, Jeremy, about your arriving here, settling in. You've only been here since February, a big change in your life. And you said you're not going to give up your home in London. So does this mean you still will be taking up offers to conduct overseas and work overseas from time to time?
I will from time to time. Obviously, my main focus is here, and that I'm very happy about. In fact, the day after we finish I Capuletti Montecchi, I go straight to London and start to rehearse Donizetti's Anna Bolena, which I'll be conducting at the Longborough Festival, one of our many summer festivals in the UK. But on the whole, no, I'm going to put my energies here. It's just that my home and my family and my city are as important to me as my new home.
Yes.
And I think nowadays it's very possible to be a genuine citizen of more than one place.
Absolutely. As someone said the other day, the world has shrunk, hasn't it?
It really has.
To get around. And, I mean, I should think it's important for you to retain your links in a place like London and in the UK and in Europe.
I think it is. I think it's partly important for the success of the job here, because ultimately I want to make sure that the best of our students have openings in Europe and America. So if I keep very much on the scene there, then, you know, I can provide them with those openings. Mm-hmm. But also, I guess, I mean, I have it also with the some of the staff in the opera school. I'm always keen that they should go off and do other things, because then they've got more to bring back. It's not enough for somebody to say, well, I remember an English National Opera in the 1970s. It was like that. It's not useful to anybody.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And while you're in South Africa, are you going to concentrate on Cape Town? I suppose you'd have to. Durban, yes. Johannesburg would be, in a sense, a distraction for you, wouldn't it? Because your focus would need to be here.
My focus does need to be, which isn't to say that I won't do anything in those places, but they'll be one-off occasions.
And right at the beginning you said what raw talent there is here, and it keeps pouring into, it seems to me, where does it all come from? It's extraordinary, actually.
It is extraordinary. I'm also the music director of the Melting Pot Choral Festival and competition here, which actually hasn't done anything for the last couple of years, but we were doing national stuff every year. And the choirs that come from all corners of this country are unbelievable in their musical and vocal abilities. It's incredible.
Do you think that you talk about the raw talent that's coming in, and we've had this extraordinary results from previously disadvantaged people coming from places like the Eastern Cape or the townships outside Cape Town, but are you aware, what is the situation with white people coming in? Is there as much enthusiasm and raw talent coming in?
I guess there's proportionally the same amount that you might find in England or Germany, or so, you know, it's a smaller proportion of the community. But I think that has a lot to do with whether one is brought up in a town or in a city or in a rural area.
Absolutely.
When you think of the great Italian singers from 100, 150 years ago, they were mainly from rural areas. There's something about that lifestyle which means that people are not carrying a lot of tension with them and they're more able to sing. Put them in an urban context and there are too many impediments.
Gosh, that's very interesting, actually. That's a very interesting concept. Mm. And clearly true, as you said, who would have thought? Because if you do think back, a lot of those Italian tenors, singers were, I almost want to say peasants initially, which they weren't, but still, still. Mm. Now, the next opera that you've chosen is one of the great operas, I have to say, of the repertoire, Verdi's Otello, his penultimate opera. And I mean, apart from the fact that it's a great piece, why have you chosen it as part of your program?
I suppose I was busy just thinking through the entire operatic repertoire. I don't think you can ever talk about opera without talking about Verdi, the great 19th century musician and dramatist. And while I love many of his operas, particularly from the middle period onwards, so the Traviatas and Trovatores and so forth, I think as he approached the end of his life, these operas became richer, musically far more interesting. The characterization got a little bit deeper. And while Falstaff, his last opera, is a great piece, Otello remains my favorite in its intensity. And I think this love duet is one of the most beautiful love duets ever written in opera.
Il mondo se dovrà
part of the love duet at the end of Act One of Otello by Verdi with Placido Domingo. That was that recording, wasn't it, Jeremy, and Katia Ricciarelli?
That's right, conducted by Mazel. It was actually a film.
That's right, it was.
A wonderful, wonderful recording.
And one of Verdi's greatest operas. I'm glad you said for you it was.
Yes, it very much is.
But we've spoken a lot about many things, and we just have a few minutes here before we have to end. So let me just remind our listeners that I've been talking to Jeremy Silver, who's the director of UCT Opera School, a new posting, which we're very excited about, Jeremy. Welcome to Cape Town.
Thank you so much.
I hope we see much more of you here at Fine Music Radio as well.
I'd love to.
As productions come and go. The opera by Bellini, I Capuleti e I Montecchi, is opening on the 15th of May. So make a note to go and see this opera. And as Jeremy said, with its beautiful Chopinesque style, which I presume is the approach you are using.
Very much so.
Good. But now before you go, you've brought along a CD that you said you didn't know whether or not to play, called Pure Silver. So I leave you just to tell us what we're going to hear and why you've chosen it.
Okay. It's in some senses, a little indulgence on my part, but also we've had such intense music up to now. This is a completely informal CD that my late wife and I recorded completely impromptu one day. I had literally been away working, and I came back one weekend, and she said, oh, I've just booked a studio. And so we went and we put down one or two opera tracks that I think she probably needed to use to send off somewhere, and ended up with an hour left. So we said, okay, well, what do you know? What do you know? And we both had a vague idea that we had slightly misspent youths playing jazz to sort of take our way through our student years. I think she was on street corners in Durban somewhere, and I was in hotels in London. So we started saying, oh, do you know this one? And do you know that one? And out of that came this completely impromptu set of songs of jazz standards, unrehearsed, which we ended up just putting together and actually selling for the Parents Teachers Association of our daughter's primary school at the time. But I just thought it's a nice memory of her, who was South African. Sadly, she died at the end of November after struggling with brain cancer. But it's also a lighter side of music, which shows a different side of my musical personality.
So which track are we going to hear? Because they're lovely tracks on here.
There's some lovely songs on there. I think All the Things You Are, the fifth track of the CD.
Okay, which is appropriate as well, if it's a lovely tribute to your wife.
Thank you.
Jeremy Silver, thank you for sharing so many interesting thoughts with us, and I'm looking forward to chatting to you again sometime and to your work here in Cape Town.
Thank you for inviting me.
Again, I've longed for adventure, something to make my heart beat the faster. What did I long for? I never really knew. Finding your love, I found my adventure. Touching your hand, my heart beats the faster. All that I want in all of this world is you. You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. Hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. And some do.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Offbeat Broadway is back, this time with an all-new show, Offbeat Broadway 5, Behaving Badly, starring Anton Lating, Lindy Abramovitz and Paul DeToy, directed by Alan Committee. Don't miss this Laugh a Second show with all the musicals you could never afford to see all in one night. A little naughty, a lot of clever, and a ton of crazy. That's Offbeat Broadway 5 from the 24th of April to the 11th of May. Only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now. FMR.